Okay, good afternoon, colleagues, members of the audience, and the general public. I'm calling to order this April 15, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. We have a bunch of items on the agenda, but as is not unusual at this point in the session, we'll be carrying over a number of bills. So if you are here eagerly awaiting the working of the following bills, you don't need to stick around. So at the risk of losing many in our audience, today we will not be working Senate Bills 414, 470, 718, 809, or 888. We're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 888, but no work session. Okay. So these bills are all in various states of amendment or analysis, so we won't be able to hear them, to work them, rather. But we do still have a number of bills that we will be working on today. And before we get started, though, colleagues, I just want to say, in case I forget later on, that we're hoping that we will finish working all the posted bills that we want to work on Monday at 3 o'clock. That's what we need to do for our deadline. But in case we can't, I'd like you to reserve Monday evening, if you could. Hopefully we won't have to come together, but just for the sake of working those remaining bills if we run out of time. It's one of the challenges, of course, with having a 1 o'clock hearing, and we have to vacate the room at 3. And in exchange for that, we will not meet next Wednesday, the Wednesday, the day after the deadline. Okay? So that's the deal I'm offering you, and I hope you'll take it. So now I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 681. I'll call up Senator Bates. And Matt, could you tell us what this bill is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 681 changes the definition of local government for the purpose of public employee benefit plans.
Welcome, Senator Bates. So what's the problem that this is going to fix?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator, District 3. And hopefully, if all goes well, other than maybe a minimum wage issue, I won't have to appear for you again. I won't be bothering you again. This will be the last time, I promise, okay? This is really a very simple bill. Back in 2013, we opened up the ability for certain governmental local governments to join PEB or OIB if they chose to. And we left one small group off. That's the Council of Governments. There's seven of them in the state, and they cover various parts of the state. And they are not allowed to join PEB. PEB has actually done a great job in the last 3 or 4 years of bringing costs down. We actually are now on a per member per month basis, got them down to less than 1% of inflation. They're actually having a deflation in their cost for health care, running wellness programs, some caps we put on, and other things. We finally brought them under control. So some of the COGs would like to join. My local COG, the Rogue Valley Council of Governments, asked that I run this bill so they could join PEB if they chose to. And that's all the bill really does. It is one of the local governments wants to get in. It would open it up for the other COGs also around the state if they want to also. So we're adding one little line to the 2013 bill that allows them in. That's all it does. I think the real reason they want to join is what I've said before. PEB is doing amazingly a good job of holding health care costs down. It's an easy way for them to get insurance for their employees at a reasonable rate. And I think it's something we should allow them to do at their option.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions of the Senator? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
I vaguely remember the bill. And I remember what we did with schools, with OWEB. And once the schools went in, it seems like they couldn't get out. Can the local governments, or in this case, the other entities, would they be able to choose to go out or, choose a different route if later they decided not to participate?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Thatcher, I will go back and find that out for you. I have to go back to the initial statute from 2013. My my discussion with COG was that they could go in and out, but I don't want to state that until I know for certain. When I asked them, do you want to get out later if things don't go so well, they said, yes, we want to be able to do that. I like that kind of a statute because it keeps people competitive, thinking twice about what they're doing. But I can't give you an absolute honest answer to that. I want to go back and research that for you.
Thank you, Senator. Yeah. Are there questions to the Senator? Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Bates.
Thank you. Thanks for hearing the bill. And
great.
And scheduling a work session. Thank you.
Thank you. We have no one else signed up to speak. Is there anyone here who does want to speak if you haven't signed up on this issue? Okay, seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 681. And we will work this bill today, but I want to wait till Senator Rosenbaum's here. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 701. And 701 was a bill that we started hearing at the very end of Wednesday's meeting. We heard from the presenters, from the sponsors of the bill. But, Matt, there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. So remind us of what Senate Bill 701 does, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 701 establishes a process for the random selection of physicians from a list of qualified physicians maintained by the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services for medical examinations and workers' compensation claims.
Great. Okay. So let's hear from John Schultz. I saw him. And Jay Fraser and Lisa Welch. Why don't you all come up? Get the DCBS SAFE perspective on this. John, you want to start off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of DCBS. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. This bill is about independent medical examinations and workers' compensation, and the purpose of an independent medical exam is to assist the insurer, the claims processor, in processing or administering the workers' compensation claim. It's scheduled typically by the claims processor or the insurer. They're scheduled when there are questions about the administration of the claim. Examples of that would be times when the insurer is trying to determine if the injury or certain conditions as they are reported as part of the claim or part of the injury are compensable, if the medical treatment being provided is appropriate, whether or not the worker's medical conditions have reached maximum improvement or medically stationary status, as we say here in Oregon. The insurer chooses the provider and pays for the examination, as well as the expenses incurred by the worker, such things as travel, child care, expenses. The insurer selects the provider from a list that's kept by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And the law currently requires a provider who wants to perform independent medical exams to meet certain standards and certify that they've taken training. The insurer may request up to 3 independent medical exams. An insurer must request permission from the director to exceed 3 independent medical examinations. And our current administrative rules do have criteria about what exams are and are not considered independent medical exams. So under the law, the director's also allowed to request a medical examination. Typically, we would do that if there's a medical treatment dispute going on between a provider and an insurer. There's also examinations that are known as worker-requested medical examinations that fall under the same basic law. And just for the committee's information, it's important to note that the legislature has spent significant time and made changes to the independent medical examination law over the last 15 years. First, in 2001, Senate Bill 485 created the worker-requested medical examination process. Initial drafts of that bill had the worker selecting the examiner from a group of 3 proposed by the insurer. In 2005, Senate Bill 311 created much of the current independent medical examination process for Oregon. Both of those bills required significant amounts of time for policy development and passage. Senate Bill 701, going to the bill, it requires the director, DCBS, to select a physician at random from the independent medical examination list. The bill requires the same random selection for the director requested examinations or worker requested examinations. The bill gives the director rulemaking authority in Section 1 under ORS 656325 to adopt rules to establish the process for random selection of a physician. And I wanted to get this onto the record. We read that authority as allowing the director to randomly select a single physician from the list of physicians certified to perform these examinations and to adopt rules for how that random selection would occur. And I wanted to bring that up because it's our intent, and based on conversations that we have had with Senator Beyer, that this selection would be random within the specialty of the examiner required, so as to avoid random selection of the wrong specialty. And examples of that would be we want to avoid concerns about having a hand specialist examining somebody with a foot injury or an oral surgeon evaluating a worker with a low back claim. The department would also establish that the examiner so selected would be available and willing to perform the examination. The insurer, the service company, or the self-insured employer would then be responsible for all further activity, such as scheduling with the provider, arranging for the worker's needs, paying for the examination, etc. The proposed Dash 1 amendments would allow the director to establish procedures for out-of-state examinations. We've met with Senator Beyer to discuss the bill. The goals he's trying to achieve are ideas about selection that I just talked about, and that we believe there's going to be a fiscal impact on the department with this bill. Based on billing and payment data reported to us, we estimate that insurers schedule about 8,000 independent medical examinations every year. If the bill's passed, we think we would use a process, I just described a minute ago, selecting randomly by specialty needed, verifying the physician selected is available to perform the exam, and under current law, workers have the right to appeal examination location, and that would continue under this bill. Based on experience and the volume of IME requests, independent medical exam requests, we expect that the department would need about 2.5 full-time equivalent or 2 full-time equivalent, 1 half-time public service representative, 4 positions to comply with the conditions of the bill. We understand Senator Beyer had hoped the proposed amendments would greatly reduce the fiscal impact, but unfortunately the amendment really doesn't. The department does not have a position on the bill or the amendments. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has heard Senate Bill 701, but has not yet taken a position on the bill. When they heard it, it was before the amendment, and they were expecting amendments. They do have the bill scheduled for their agenda for this Friday on April 17th. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions I can. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we'll come back to you, John. Thank you. Hello.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Jay Fraser. I'm here on behalf of Safe Corporation. But before I get started on the bill, I'd like to remind you a little bit about SAFE and our unique position in the Oregon workers' compensation system. SAFE is Oregon State Chartered Workers' Compensation Insurer. We are a not-for-profit entity charged by our enabling statutes to provide workers' compensation coverage to as many employers as inexpensively as possible while protecting the Industrial Accident Fund and while applying sound principles of insurance. As a public entity, we believe SAFE exists to serve and protect the Oregon workforce, meeting the needs of workers and employers. We believe that this strengthens Oregon's economy. My colleague Lisa Wilch and I sit before you from this unique perspective to offer a few comments on this proposal and our concerns about the effect on the workers' compensation system. But first, I'd like to give you a little perspective. Over the past 2 years, SAFE Corporation has had a combined 74,445 claims with an injury date of 2013 or 2014. Of these nearly 75,000 claims, approximately 7,500, or about 10%, have had one or more IMEs. but only 712 of those 7,500 claims have had more than one independent medical examination. What this really means is of the 66,876 claims, they have not had an IME. That's just under 90%. IMEs are paid for by the insurer, as Mr. Schultz has indicated, and they are expensive both in cost and in administrative process and time. SAFE is judicious in deciding to send a worker to an independent medical examination. With this background, I'd like to ask, if it's all right with you, Chair Dembro, ask Ms. Wilch to talk to you a little bit more about the technical aspects of 701.
Thank you, Jay. Yes.
Chair Dembro, committee members. My name is Lisa Wilch. I've been at SAFE for almost 42 years, which is about 40% of the entire workers' compensation history in Oregon. I've been involved on a variety of levels, training new adjusters, almost 200 adjusters through the initial certification class. I've trained on the Senate Bill 311 that John referenced earlier. I've done training at the GOSH conference and the Workers' Comp Educational Conference. I've been employed by a variety of positions at SAFE, and I have personal knowledge and in the area of independent medical examinations in that I administered our contract process with the providers. I've conducted quality reviews of independent medical examinations. I've trained numerous times on the topic. In addition, I have my own personal experience with a spouse who was an injured worker, and he had had two shoulder claims and a carpal tunnel claim. The two shoulder claims went through a total of three IMEs, and I attended the IMEs with him so that I could observe the process from the other side. The carpal tunnel claim did not result in an IME, but we actually selected the physician that he treated with based on my own experience with a specialist in that area. We schedule IMEs to help with the medical aspect of the claim, getting a medical history, mechanism of injury. John kind of alluded to the various times we might involve an IME examiner. The IME must be well-reasoned and based on medical probability. We select the provider based on a variety of reasons: demonstrated experience with evaluating that particular body part, thorough, well-reasoned, and timely reports, the availability of the physician within a specific time frame to meet the needs of the claims management experience, someone in the geographic area as much as possible. And a good physician, a good IME physician, renders an opinion based on the facts, the examination of the worker, and a review of the medical record, and does it on both sides. The decisions are for the worker. They might be in support of a denial, but a good examiner can issue reports on both sides of the fence. Nobody wants to go through an IME. I'm sure none of you want to go and see a physician you don't have a relationship with, but it is an integral part of managing claims in Oregon. It creates a lot of anxiety for the worker, and we try to alleviate that by having a communication protocol with the worker. So if we're intending to schedule an IME, we'll pick up the phone and call them, talk to them about the needs for the management of the claim, and then we will try to make arrangements so that they're seen maybe in their geographic area. Some workers want to be seen by a male or a female physician. Some workers don't want to travel to the metropolitan area, so we try to alleviate those concerns in scheduling. 47% of our IMEs from 2011 through 2014 were scheduled to determine the compensability of the injury or the occupational disease. Randomly selected providers may result in a decrease in timely compensability decisions because we would have to incorporate the time it would take for WCD to complete their process. It's important to note that of the compensability IMEs from 2011 through 2014 based on SAFE's data, 55% of these examinations resulted in an acceptance of the claim on the worker's behalf. So it could delay necessary medical treatment. A delay in medical treatment may affect the worker's recovery and their ability to return to work. It could affect our timely decision making. It could eliminate our flexibility around allowing the worker to schedule a male or female examiner. And we pick physicians based on their demonstrated experience in either compensability or maybe they're good at doing closing evaluations. Some doctors don't like to get into the compensability analysis because it's fairly complex when you have a pre-existing condition. So on the policyholder side, we may have interim benefits that continue longer because of the additional time that it takes to pick a random physician. And it may delay curative treatment. And they might need to hire a temporary worker to take that worker's place. WCD would be using the same list of authorized IME examiners that they currently use. And the booklet that is provided to potential IME providers, I think it's in the record. This booklet on the first two pages will tell you that WCD mandates that these examinations be objective, and that their role is to examine the worker, have an unbiased report. A lot of this was rolled out in 2005. So I think the current process should alleviate the concerns. I don't think, and John can speak to this, I don't think any IME providers have been removed from the list because of issues with not following the conduct standards in this booklet. So with that, do you have any questions for me?
Thank you very much, Ms. Welch. Any questions for the panel? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, that is the workers' comp provider that chooses the physician for the IME, correct?
It's the insurer that chooses the physician
insurer,
for the IME
based
on the workers' comp department's list.
Okay. So the injured employee does not get a choice, really?
No.
Okay.
But if we know that the attending physician deals really well with a particular provider, maybe in their geographic area that does IMEs, we might select that physician because we already know they respect the IME examiner that would be evaluating the worker.
So then the department would kind of weigh in?
Well, the department would pick a random physician and would not probably allow us to select a physician that might be agreeable to us and also agreeable to the worker's attending physician.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Schultz, I think the bill came before us out of a sense of maybe there was not fairness, or potential lack of fairness here. And I'm wondering, has the agency heard many complaints about the process?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I, in preparation for this hearing, I thought that question might come up. So I asked the same thing of our staff, and they provided the following to me, that the number of complaints we've received since January 1st, 2012 from workers, because there is a complaint process, we've had 62 complaints from workers. In evaluating those complaints, the number of times that we found the complaint was well-founded enough to either investigate or provide more education was 16 times out of those 62. So over the amount of independent medical examinations that are conducted, that's a pretty small percentage. However, I also think that workers, even though they're provided with information about the complaint process, probably don't always realize that it's available to them. So, but that's the data I have.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. This has been very helpful. And again, Mr. Schultz, this is going to be taken up by MLAC on Friday, is your understanding?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay.
It's on their agenda.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all. All right. Finally, we have Hasina Squires and Betsy Earls. Is Betsy here? Yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires, and I'm here today not representing an insurance company, but on behalf of the Independent Medical Examination Association. Our association consists of six member facilities who are, one might term them, the buffer between an insurer and a physician who conducts IMEs. Our member facilities recruit and retain physicians to perform IMEs and our work with companies like SAFE in order to get injured workers back to work and select the correct physician and hopefully in a timely manner get those exams conducted. I will not repeat anything that SAFE testified to, but could not agree more with their comments. We are here to oppose the bill in its current form. I'll just add just a few things that I think are missing. As you all are aware, ORS 656.012 stipulates the legislative goals for the workers' compensation system, and that is one of fairness. And in the beginning, fairness included, to your question, Senator Thatcher, the ability for an injured worker to select their own attending physician, and that still remains the case. In exchange, insurers were provided the authority to select three independent IMEs, and that this would alter that balance from our perspective. I'd like to just also highlight a little bit more about the Senate Bill 311, 2005 reforms that were made. This was an extremely contentious issue in 2005, and there were a lot of complaints about potential bias in the system, and whether it was true bias or perception of bias. There was a significant piece of legislation that was passed in 2005. Our association was instrumental in working with the Workers' Compensation Department to get that piece of legislation passed. And it included some very key provisions that require physicians to receive training by WCD on the workers' compensation system and the appropriateness of what an IME constitutes. It also requires those physicians to abide by a code of conduct. It requires a quality assurance statement to be included at the end of the IME report. And furthermore, it allows the department to investigate complaints. And if there are complaints, workers are afforded that ability through Mr. Schiltz, who can fully conduct an investigation. As you've heard, from our perspective, there doesn't seem to be an issue with complaints based on the large volume and number of IMEs that are conducted. And since there have been 62 filed complaints since 2012, 16 of those with somewhat of merit, that's less than 1%, less than 1% of all of the IMEs where there's been a complaint. I would encourage the committee to look further into whether or not there is a problem that needs to be solved and if this is the appropriate way to address a potential assertion that there is a perception of bias in the system, and ask that you oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, also appearing in opposition to Senate Bill 701, representing Associated Oregon Industries. Did I say that? I won't echo what has already been said today. I think you've heard a lot of good testimony. The point I would make is that the system as we see it right now is fairly balanced between the employee's ability to choose IME providers and the employer's ability to choose IME providers. It's especially important to the employer community to be able to choose three IME providers of their own, because workers' compensation injuries and diseases are becoming increasingly complex, and employers know, insurers know that there are certain IME providers that have specialties in different areas, and when it is very important to them, they need to be able to go to pay a premium and go to one of those providers that has a specialty in a very complex area in order to provide the best information to the treating physician. So this bill would completely abrogate that ability of employers to choose, and we would ask you to not move it forward.
Thank you. Questions for either of our panelists? Okay, thank you both very much.
Actually,
Vice Chair Thatcher.
I guess I didn't ask the last panel, but maybe you do know how many
IME exams are there in a year? You said it amounted to about 1% of the claims, so what does that come to? Quick math.
I think you said 8,000.
Yeah, 8,000. Okay, wow.
That's a lot.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you both.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right. Anybody else want to speak on this? Okay, I'm going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 701. Colleagues, we don't have a work session scheduled for this until Monday. We'll hear what MLAC has to say on Friday, and that'll help inform our decision, I think. So next up, we have Senate Bill 888. And I think Senator Gelser, are you going to speak to this? And while she's going down, Matt, would you please tell us what SB 888 is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 888 requires employers to provide employees upon hire a written work schedule, permits employees to request a flexible or predictable work schedule from the employer subject to certain restrictions, requires the employer to grant the employee's request for a flexible or predictable work schedule, and unless presented by a bona fide business reason, requires the employee to post in an accessible location a physical copy of the work schedule for all employees, and requires the employer to pay for scheduled hours of work, regardless of hours actually worked, up to a maximum of 4 hours. The measure requires or grants the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries authority to adopt additional rules. It additionally requires employers to provide notice of scheduled changes and compensate employees for changes in certain circumstances. The measure also establishes an unlawful employment practice of retaliating against any employee who requests flexible or predictable scheduling and defines relevant terms. There are a few amendments to this bill, including there's only a single amendment. There's a single amendment, the dash one amendments, which would place provisions in the measure, or would place the measure within ORS Chapter 653. Would require employers to provide a work schedule 21 days in advance and requires employers to compensate employees for changes in their work schedule.
Thank you, Matt. Senator Gelser, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members,
welcome down there. We already welcomed you up here.
You did. Thanks. Now I feel very, very welcome. So thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record, I'm Sarah Gelser from Senate District 8, Albany and Corvallis. I do want to put on the record that while Waffle Wednesday was canceled for everyone else, we did personally deliver extra waffles to Senator Knope's office.
Well, maybe we should vote on this bill today.
It's called waffle diplomacy. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 888 is intended to start a discussion about the importance of workers being able to know when it is that they're expected to be at work so that they can perform the duties that their employers have hired them to do, and they can also make the plans necessary to care for their children and their families. Interestingly, I was driving into work the other day, and this issue was on a morning news broadcast. It was talking about different companies that are looking for ways to better have this conversation with their workers. Imagine for a moment that you don't know on a day-to-day basis what time you are needed to report to work, or if you are needed to report to work. You work in a low-wage job. You are a single parent with young kids. In order to go to work, you have to have your child care provider. Your child care provider does not know when she is going to work until you know when you are going to work. So you can see how this has a cascading impact. There are 12 cities and states in the United States that have some fair scheduling laws on the books, and an additional 9 localities have active campaigns around this issue. As I said, many low-wage and hourly workers in our state are unable to predict when they will work, how many hours they will get per week, and what kind of paycheck they can expect. So this also goes to not just managing your schedule, but managing your bills and knowing how much rent you can afford to pay. This is in part because some employers have increased the use of just-in-time scheduling, where you don't know until the beginning of the shift whether you're actually going to be needed to be there or not. This means that there are some workers that are permanently on call. They wait for that phone to ring to know that they need to come in, or they report to work and don't know until they've reported to work whether or not they will be required to stay. Some are required to be available up to 2 hours before a shift, only to be told they aren't needed, which means that they can't get a second job or arrange for childcare. And when they aren't needed, it means they're paying for childcare that they ended up not needing. And if they don't, it means that that has had that cascading effect again to that childcare worker. As I said, it also means that those workers do not know what their monthly income will be, and this challenges their budgets and their capacity to get ahead. For those workers on the lowest wages, one day of being called off work or sent home early can mean their family doesn't have the money to pay for gas or food. Oregonians are not just workers, but also family members, caregivers, and contributing members of their communities who need to be able to rely on regular schedules, have the opportunity to arrange work schedules around some caregiving responsibilities, and predict their paychecks. For some families, that might be the ability to have a flexible schedule so that they are able to meet caregiving needs at home. For other families, it may mean that they need a predictable schedule so they are able to keep their child in regular and consistent child care. Unfair scheduling also has knock-off effects on students, especially those in community colleges, where they are unable to plan their school schedules around their work schedules if their work schedule is unpredictable. 3 in 10 community college students are also raising children, and 4 in 10 female community college students are mothers. These parents work an average of 25 hours a week on top of getting an education and caring for their children. For student parents, it can be an impossible task to care for children and juggle the demands of work and school if they don't have that basic information around what they need to do and where they need to be. Senate Bill 888 really is intended to launch a conversation about how we can accommodate these needs of a diverse workforce of individuals that are workers and caregivers, and also meet the needs of the businesses that are employing them. You'll note in Senate Bill 888 that if there is a bona fide reason why the employer cannot accommodate that, the employer does not need to accommodate that change. So, for example, a worker wouldn't be able to say, I can't have childcare in the morning, so I can only work in the afternoon, and it's a coffee shop that closes at 3 o'clock. This bill would not require that the coffee shop change its hours. The request needs to fit within the business model of the business and the hours of operation of the business. So there are others here that will talk to you more about the logistics of this bill. But as I said, my deepest hope is that we can start that conversation about how we can help families find this work-family balance, how we can make it possible for people to provide responsible and safe care and support for their families, and also put in a quality day of work. Doing that means you need to know where you need to be, when you need to be there, how long you're going to be there, and how much you're going to have at the end of the month to pay your bills. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Gelzer? Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much. Okay. Can we have Dana? Do you pronounce your last name? Vissi. Okay, Dana and Lily Hogue, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Dumbrow and committee members. My name is Dana Vissi. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share my perspective about fair scheduling. This is an issue that's hidden. It's not really talked about enough, and yet it affects families directly and with significant impact, families just like mine. For 6 years, I worked for an urban planning firm. For the first 3 years, I worked full-time, received excellent reviews, and steadily gained responsibility. But things changed once I became a mother. After my first unpaid family leave, I asked to work an 80% schedule with Fridays off. My employer agreed, and I kept the schedule for another 2 years. My performance reviews remained excellent, and after getting pregnant with my second son, I asked to work 24 hours a week, or 60%, so that I could care for my son while my husband worked. Again, my employer agreed. But then at the end of my unpaid maternity leave, I was laid off with no warning, no severance, and no explanation other than there was no work for me. I was actually told that I'd get an excellent recommendation, and it had nothing to do with my work performance. A few days later, I learned that another woman, not a mother, was hired full-time and moved into the space that I had vacated doing very similar work. I believe that my request to work a flexible schedule led to my termination. I believe that I was penalized for asking for a flexible schedule, and that if I had not made this request, that my job would not have been terminated. I was not given the choice to continue working my old schedule or full-time. Instead, assumptions were made about my work commitment, regardless of my performance, and just because I had asked for a reduced schedule. The loss of my job with no valid explanation was very difficult for me and has changed the course of my work life. The blow to my ability to earn a living and contribute to my family has had significant impact. These days, losing one income in a household that depends on two can be financially very devastating. Please support legislative policies like this proposal that encourage and support fair scheduling so that mothers and others can earn a living and excel at both their family and their work commitments. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Chair Denborough, members of the committee. My name is Lily Hogue. I'm the policy director at Family Forward Oregon. Thanks for the opportunity today to support Senate Bill 888 and the Dash 1 amendments. These protections are particularly important for women who make up nearly 65% of the 200,071 and 200 workers in Oregon's low-wage workforce, where these scheduling practices are most common. Family Forward Oregon believes that workers should have adequate advance notice of their schedules, be guaranteed some measure of predictability, and be able to ask for an alternate schedule without fear of retaliation. We are grateful to the Senator and to the Speaker and Representative Fagan for starting this very important conversation, and we look forward to working on it now and in future sessions. So if you don't mind, I'd like to take you through the provisions of the Dash 1 amendments briefly. So Section 1 places the provisions of the bill in ORS Chapter 653, Oregon's wage and hour laws. Section 2 is definitions. So Sections 3 and 8 are the right to request provisions. Employees who currently have no job protection for requesting a more flexible schedule or a predictable schedule, and all too often they never make the request because they're afraid of retaliation. An employee should never fear that retaliation, and so we think that we can find a way that an employer and an employee could agree to a mutually acceptable schedule. So under Sections 3 and 8, employees would have the right to request an alternate schedule and be protected from retaliation for making the request. Employers have the right to deny most requests, but must engage in an interactive process with the employee to attempt to find a mutually acceptable schedule. In very limited circumstances, there is a right to receive unless there is a bona fide business reason that the request cannot be granted. And these reasons include serious health condition of an employee, the employee's caregiving responsibilities for a family member, or a second job of the employee. And bona fide business reason is defined in Section 2.1 sub A. The right to request provision is applicable to both hourly and salaried employees. Section 4 is schedule predictability. So what we know is that unpredictable scheduling happens in a number of ways. It happens when employers give their employees only an hour's notice or a schedule within a few days. It can also mean receiving a work schedule that's subject to frequent changes with little notice, disrupting employees' out-of-work responsibilities. So Section 4 provides that employees must be provided with their work schedule with at least 21 days advance notice, and that changes to an employee's schedule after the initial hire must also be provided with 21 days notice. Employers would have to post a schedule of all employees in a location accessible to the employees and would have to provide that schedule on request of employees. Section 5 is show-up pay. So Section 5 is about when an employee is not scheduled for a consistent number of hours and they can't count on a predictable income, if they can't hold a second job to supplement that income or predict childcare. So if the employee shows up for work and is sent home with no hours, they should still be paid for a portion of their shift. This law is actually already exists for minors in Oregon. We think it should apply to adults. So under Section 5, and if an employee is scheduled to work a shift of 4 hours or more and is sent home without work, they must be paid for at least 4 hours of their shift. If the scheduled shift is less than 4 hours, they will be paid for whatever the hours their shift was scheduled for. And there's an exemption for shifts that are canceled for reasons beyond the employer's control. Section 6 is predictability pay. So sometimes schedules we know need to change, and there does need to be some flexibility for employers to make changes when necessary. However, employees should also be compensated for these last-minute changes. When the amount of hours that a worker is assigned varies, it's difficult for workers to meet expenses or their budgets. So Section 6 would apply if an employer needs to change an employee's schedule with less than 21 days advance notice, but with more than 24 hours notice. The employer would be required to pay the employee 1 hour of wages for every shift changed. For schedule changes made less than 24 hours of advance notice, the employer would be required to pay the employee for 4 hours of wages for the shift change. So this creates kind of a two-tiered approach depending on the amount of advance notice that's given to the employee. It's only 1 hour of additional pay if the notice is changed between 21 days and 24 hours, and under 24 hours, it's 4 hours pay. If the employee is put on call and has to call in within 72 hours of a shift to find out whether or not they work, they would receive 4 hours of predictability pay for that on-call time. And so that's for low-wage workers who we know are, there's a lot of folks who are now being put on permanent on-call, and so may not be given any or few hours and might have to show up but not be given actually any pay or hours to work. This also includes if an employee is required to work two non-consecutive shifts in one 24-hour period. So they would receive compensation for this. This is called clopenings, for instance, when somebody has to close, say, until midnight and be back at work at 7 a.m. Section 7 is enforcement provisions. So this gives BOLI standard enforcement authority under Chapter 653. And Section 8 is retaliation provisions for the right to request. So we are open to your feedback, and thank you for bringing up this important subject.
Thank you, Lily. This is very comprehensive and is touching on a number of very real problems. Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where did you come up with 21 days?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Knope. There's some national work that's being done on this, and this is part of best practice. We actually talked about 21 days because 3 weeks is a reasonable amount of time to be able to schedule child care or another job, but also gives employers some flexibility so it's not 4 months in advance, for instance. But we're always open to feedback about that.
Other questions? Okay, thank you both
thank you very much.
Art Towers and Matt Swanson. We seem to have lost Matt, but it's such a delight to have Arthur. We won't notice.
Ooh. Just when I got used to his new role.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, a political director for Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I wanted to testify on this important topic on behalf of our members who work on employment issues and on behalf of their clients. Our members address a number of issues in this area in employment law relating to discrimination for age, gender, disability, and I was surprised that they also are handling a number of cases regarding discrimination around family status. They also work with whistleblowers, retaliation around workers' comp claims, and wrongful termination. And they flagged the issue of unfair scheduling as is, one of the more severe problems that they see among their clientele. And so I did want to get OTLA on the record on this issue. But I also wanted to testify based on my personal experience as well in this area. My daughter's a restaurant manager working 50 to 60 hours a week. And she's here in the last 9 months or so moved in with us and with her two daughters. She finds out on Thursday what her schedule is going to be for the upcoming week, and a couple days a week she'll work 4 p.m. until about 2 a.m. 2 days a week she'll work 5 a.m. until 2 p.m. and then she'll work a day a week 10 to 6 or roughly those hours. Blessedly, she doesn't have the clopening problem, but again, she'll find out Thursday what her week's like. And in terms of The kids, you know, thank God the grandma was able to care for the kids after school, getting them off to school, wherever the case may be. But what I've seen is just how bad this is for my granddaughters. It is just miserable. They don't get what they need from their mom because she's perpetually exhausted. The other piece that I would say is that because of the impact this has on her, I think that it really was detrimental to her marriage. It was detrimental to her decision-making process because perpetually tired, she thinks about things differently than she does when she's better rested. Now, in the last few weeks, she's been able to find a different job, but take a meaningful pay cut to get a more regular schedule. And even in those past few weeks, I've seen a difference in the granddaughters in terms of, like, teachers reporting better behavior in school, just a whole myriad of things. And so I just wanted to share that as well, because I do feel that the impact of this, scheduling policies on families is, really hidden from public sight, but runs very, very deep in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Arthur. Matt, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Matt Swanson, representing the Service Employees International Union, Locals 49 and 503. Together, we represent just over 60,000 working people in the state of Oregon. And I think I want to, I'll try to be brief. There's a couple of specific groups who we work with who really see the problems with just-in-time scheduling or new scheduling techniques and how they impact the family, but also the ability of workers to get ahead. And one group that comes to mind is our child care providers who work with ERDC clients who are often in the same sort of circumstance that Mr. Towers was describing. You have moms and dads out working hard. They're not earning a lot of money, and they're just trying to get by. And they can be scheduled week to week in varying hours. And as a parent myself, I know that arranging childcare is one of the biggest stresses, and arranging last minute childcare is, horrifying, because you want your child to be well cared for. At the same time, you have to get to work. So many of our child care providers see that day in and day out, and it's not just the traditional 9-to-5 schedule before and after school that you think of. You also have people who are working swing and graveyard shifts, so family, friends, and neighbors in their network are having to pick up people at very odd hours. And that's one of the things that I think is really important as we consider how we address scheduling moving forward. I think another, and just the predictability, I think, feeds into that, because it's a lot harder to make arrangements on that swing shift schedule week to week versus, say, having a more regular and predictable month-to-month calendar. The other place that this really comes up, where we've seen kind of on the flip side, is scheduling in some of the healthcare facilities that do operate 24/7, where we do represent workers. Oftentimes, the workers and management, through their partnership, have been able to figure out how to provide some flexibility and predictability in an industry that does have round-the-clock and often emergent situations with a variety of staff. So I think that this is an important conversation. We certainly support moving forward and thank Senator Gelser and others for bringing this important legislation forward. And I think I was across the way, so hopefully I'm not repeating anything that has come up already, but we're just very pleased that this conversation is moving forward and are ready to be supportive in any way we can.
Thank you, Matt. Questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you very much for that testimony. So we had Bob Russell and John Chandler, but they seem to have disappeared. So we'll call up Betsy Earls and Jan Meekums, please.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm sorry that our male colleagues have disappeared, but we'll do what we can, right?
Right. Girl power.
Yeah, exactly. AOI appearing before you in opposition to Senate Bill 888, but certainly interested in continuing the conversation that I believe that you've started here. The bill addresses several different industries, obviously, but since we represent the Retail Council, I wanted to just talk with you a little bit about the retail perspective on some of the flex scheduling bills, because that is the group of our members that I've probably heard the most from about these. And I think, you know, the thing that they want you to know or to take into account the most is that when retailers are developing their employee schedules, they consider, of course, a variety of external factors as well as the internal factors. And I think, obviously, internal factors include their employees' preferences and needs and the things that they've worked out with them in the, you know, in the past. But the external factors that they look at include sales forecasts, the productivity of the store, historic payroll and hour reports, current workload, weather predictions is a huge one. The marketing that they've been doing and other in-store events, product delivery schedules, and customer traffic patterns. Most of those are not fixed variables. So I think some things retailers can predict better than others. Obviously, they know when they're going to have a big in-store promotion. They know when a holiday is coming. But the other factors are highly variable, and a really important one to keep in mind is weather patterns. A store, especially when you get, you know, around fall and winter, a store can have a schedule pretty tightly drawn up to take into account all of the other factors that we've just talked about, because they have historical data on what their customer traffic looks like on certain days of the year, you know, and at certain times of the day, and that is getting more and more informative as we advance further with technology. But you can take into account all those factors, have a big snowstorm hit overnight 100 miles away, 200 miles away, that disrupts a delivery. Deliveries are scheduled to be just in time, and I mean just in time, really anymore. And probably you've seen or heard that before, but really it's planned based on what they know about historical patterns of customer traffic, what they're going to need at a certain time of day. But then the deliveries don't come. And there are employees that are scheduled to work, but they can get to work, obviously, because it's not snowing in and around the store, but the product doesn't come. And a bill like this would mean that the employer wouldn't be able to send them home because the work wasn't there for them. Unloading, stocking, they would be there without anything to do, really. So under these bills, the retailer will be required to compensate those employees for some of the or all of the hours that they had planned to work, even though the change was really due to factors beyond the retailer's control. So I think a lot of our retail members schedule reasonably far out, probably 2 weeks is when they start drafting up schedules and try to have those firmed up. And the bill that is before you now goes pretty far closer in toward the actual work time. So we would just ask you to take into account, as the conversation goes on, the fact that there are external things out there that really impact retailer and other employers' ability to make an exact and firm schedule.
Thank you, Betsy. Hey, Jack.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity today to speak with you. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We are an association of about 7,000 small privately owned businesses. Nationally, we have about 350,000 members. And we've been representing and advocating on the part of our small business members since 1943. And for several years, NFIB has actually been promoting the notion of the flex schedule. Our archives are full of articles and recommendations of when and how and if to implement such a plan. But of course, it's all predicated, as was mentioned by Ms. Earls, upon the ability of an employer to realistically employ that type of model for their business. We have a very broad spectrum of members, from agriculture to forest to restaurants to service, retail, manufacturing. They all fall within our membership. And there are probably almost as many different schedule models as there are types of business in Oregon. For that reason, we find this a very challenging, if not troubling, bill. I provided written testimony. Some of the issues that are of most concern to us is there is some of the arbitrary nature within the bill, such as the specific definition, how it would be applied, bona fide business reason, substantial cost to the employer, detrimental effect, and inability to reorganize. The other things are within the bill in my written testimony. Part of the issue that always comes up for small businesses is it could be an administrative nightmare, not only in working out all the scheduling for the employees, posting for the employees, but figuring out the additional payroll that now was due to employees under specific circumstances. For some of our small businesses, it would be just totally unworkable. We appreciate the intent. We'd like to be at the table and see what could be done to alleviate some of the very valid issues that are being addressed here. But the bill, as it is written and presented today, NFIB is strongly opposed to. And I thank you for your time and opportunity.
Thank you, Jan. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your perspective. I have a question, then we'll open it up. You know, we've heard a sense that this is a growing problem, and I'm speaking specifically of the problem of just-in-time, you know, work hours. You know, that it's a growing problem, A, because it's happening more often, and B, because, you know, as you have more non-traditional families, you know, it's just difficult. And in addition, with more work going from full-time to part-time, is that your sense, you know, from what you hear from the people you represent, that this is a growing practice and a growing problem?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think that it what's growing is the ability of employers and especially retailers to predict what's going to happen next, and the amount of time that they have to predict that in. The advent of big data has made it much easier for them to understand a bunch of different things that are going to happen and when, you know, and obviously get closer to that just-in-time scheduling, just-in-time delivery. The other thing that we have seen change quite a bit in the last several years is an increase in the number of people that want to work part-time and that are really choosing to come to work for retailers because they offer those flexible schedules, you know, which is another way of looking at flex scheduling, obviously. But so I think those are the two things that are the most different. I haven't heard a lot about non-traditional families and how that would impact the bill that you're looking at. But I think those are kind of the two biggest changes we see.
And I would just like to add to that kind of a little nuance is that I think with the advent of technology, that the details that can be tracked within a business, and I think sometimes the margin of profits are less, maybe the gross income is less, but they can massage details in order to maintain a bottom line, but they also can get disrupted very, very easily because of that too. And I just think we have such a changing landscape for employers, and we have a changing landscape for employees, which I think why this discussion is appropriate today.
Thank you. Yeah, my concern is this is going to be a growing problem, just because of the, you know, growing ability or adoption of technology that allows you to do that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a concern that right now this, you know, it's the workers who are bearing the brunt of this. And so I do very much appreciate the notion that this is something that parties need to get together and try to figure out, okay, how can we do this so that it's not unduly burdensome on one party or the other. Other questions? Or okay, thank you both. All right, we've heard from the women. Let's hear from the men, or at least one. Mr. Chandler.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to Senate Bill 888. And as this discussion has unfolded this session and the various bills that are dealing with this topic. I understand, and from the testimony I've listened to, I understand what the problem is that we're trying to fix. I've just been absolutely baffled as to how it would work in the construction industry and the people I represent, because we're dealing with, if you're thinking about a house being built, 20 to 30 subcontractors, all of whom presumably be subject to a rule of this sort, and the process of building anything, be it a house or a garage or a shopping center, is sequential, and certain things have to happen, and before other things can happen, everything is an assembly line, if you will, that each step of which is critical, and once you start monkeying with the pieces of that, the whole thing goes sideways. And I'm not necessarily arguing the principle behind the bill. I'm just struggling to see how it would apply in our situation. You have a framing, the site work has to be done before the foundation can be poured. The foundation has to be done before the framing can start. The framing has to be done before the sheetrock, and so on. If you have a flexible schedule issue, that backs up the entire process before and after. And that's just very, very unworkable in an industry where everything is determined, like you heard in the previous panel, by events that you can't control. If something goes wrong on a job site, or material isn't ready, or somebody else doesn't show up, it just creates a huge mess. And I'm not trying to say we ought to be written out of the bill, but I am saying that our industry is not unique in that regardless of how whether or not the flex scheduling is a good idea or not, it's going to be very difficult to implement in certain circumstances. And because I do represent an industry where I think that's going to apply, I think I want to put that on the record as this conversation goes forward, that this is going to be extraordinarily difficult given the industry we're in and how we're structured in terms of subcontractors, general contractors, most of whom are small businesses. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll be glad to close and take questions.
Thank you. So in the construction industry, or home building more specifically, are you seeing any changes in the employment practice, you know, as we are seeing in retail or, you know, some of the other sectors? Or has this always been, are you saying this has always been sort of a hallmark or a characteristic of the industry, that it's been kind of, schedules have been very flexible and unpredictable?
Mr. Chair, the latter. As far as I know, I have not heard of any particular changes in the employment patterns, other than we can't get enough workers, for which I'd refer to you to the various CTE bills floating through this process as a way of getting more people in the pipeline to work in construction. But you can't really change the way the system works. It's not, even if you're doing prefab or modular, you still have the same problems of sequence of events. You can't, if the roofer's handy and the roof isn't ready to be put on, it doesn't matter that the roofer's handy, it waits. And I don't think that even my more progressive members who are, or union shops or others, still have that same phenomenon to deal with. It has nothing to do with the philosophy behind the employment practice. It simply has to do with the nature of the work.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Chandler? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I guess we just have Tricia Smith, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I am here representing Oregon School Employees Association, a union of approximately 20,000 educational employees working in both the private and the public sector. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 888 and the -1 amendments. We have members in the private sector who feel that they are suffering dramatically from just-in-time scheduling. As an example, I'll give you one of our members that you've actually met. She came to testify on one of the paid sick days bills on President's Day, which is a holiday in schools. So she planned to come and testify. It was very important to her and to her members that she do that. She thought that would be safe because it was a holiday, school would not be open. Just a few days before she was coming, her employer notified everyone that they must attend a mandatory meeting on President's Day. The purpose of the meeting was to do some paperwork that the employer was supposed to have done in December as a result of a training. The paperwork wasn't completed, so the employer decided to bring the employees in on the holiday to complete the paperwork. The member asked to be excused from that meeting so she could attend the hearing and was told she must attend the meeting. She came to the hearing and was disciplined as a result. Our members suffer from both being forced to come to work on unscheduled days and being unable to work on scheduled days. This creates a huge financial burden on our members who can't, as someone else testified to earlier, can't manage their finances when they don't know how much money they're going to have this month, how many days they're going to work this month. It also puts a tremendous burden on their families when they can't find childcare for an unscheduled shift that they suddenly get scheduled for. And then the last thing I would offer you as something to think about on this issue. The current system, before I say that, I want to say that I'm very encouraged to hear those who are in opposition to the bill as it's written right now indicate that they recognize this is a problem and that it needs a solution, and they're ready to help us try to find that solution. We hope that you will continue this discussion and keep it alive so that we can continue that discussion, because the problem is serious. And the last thing I would offer you as a reason to do that is the current system works for half of this equation. I don't think you've heard anyone testify that any employer is being arbitrary, capricious, mean, nasty, horrible. There may be very legitimate reasons why these shift changes occur. The problem is that today, when they occur, the worker bears the cost. And that's not fair. And I hope that you can find some solutions that will help us with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Tricia. Any questions for Ms. Smith? Okay, thank you very much, Tricia. Okay, with that, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 888. And we will do a couple of work sessions. Let's go back to Senate Bill 681, the one that we heard from Senator Bates at the beginning of this meeting. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 681. And again, colleagues, this is the one that would extend to special districts the ability to do what cities and counties can do in terms of opting into PEB. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 681 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 681 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of this?
Well, Mr. Chair,
yes.
I still have that question. I hope that people, that these entities can opt out. Do you know the answer to that question?
I don't know. I know school districts can opt out once. I think that's how it works. And then if they go back in, they have to stay in. I think that's how it works. I'm not sure with the legislation that we passed in 2013 that it opened it up to cities and counties. I don't know. But, you know, certainly we'll have the answer to that before the floor vote.
Okay, so I'll be a courtesy yes for now, depending on the answer.
Okay.
Right, thanks.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, is there any opposition to us passing Senate Bill 681 to the floor? Hearing none. So ordered. And we'll have Senator Bates carry this. Right, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 681. And let us open a work session on Senate Bill 492. And Matt, remind us of what this one was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 492 allows certain employees to use sick leave or personal business leave for the purpose of handling matters related to domestic violence, harassment, sexual assault, or stalking. The fiscals came in pretty late for a lot of these things. So there is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact with this bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 492 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 492 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of this? This is the one that Senator Mona Sanderson brought to us. Is that right? Okay. Is there any opposition to Senate Bill 492? Okay. Seeing none, Senate Bill 492 will go to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, and Senator Mona Sanderson will carry. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 492 and open work session on Senate Bill 598. Okay, colleagues, Senate Bill 598 is the bill that would create the task force on apprenticeship for the 21st century. And Dash 3 amendments to this, and the Dash 3 amendments make a couple of changes. They add a couple of community college people to the task force. One of the charges of the task force is to look at ways that community colleges can work more effectively in the apprenticeship system, particularly in the rural areas. And so this calls for having two community college people who work in apprenticeship programs or pre-apprenticeship programs, at least one of whom must be a faculty member. And it also it makes a couple of other changes. There was a sort of parallel bill over on the House side, and we've taken some of the elements of that and incorporated it into this bill. Clarifies that some of the members, you know, at least two of the members, have to be from rural parts of the state, and makes some other charges about, you know, that call for looking at various challenges that businesses face in finding apprentices. So. That's what the Dash 3s do, and I would welcome a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendment dated April 9th, 2015.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved the Dash 3 amendments dated April 9th, 2015. Any discussion of this? Okay, is there any objection to the amendments? All right, seeing none, the Dash 3 amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chair, I move to move Senate Bill 598 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 598 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, since it's a good task force bill. Any discussion? Okay, is there any objection to this motion? Okay, seeing none, it is so ordered. This bill will go to Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 598, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 311. Okay, we're on a task force roll here. So, colleagues, remember this was Senator Shields' bill that would allow foster parents to unionize, essentially. This bill has instead become a task force bill that I think will serve a very important purpose. Matt, do you want to give us an idea of what's in the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This amendment replaces the measure by creating a task force to study and report on the qualifications, recruitment, training, support, screening, compensation, and oversight of foster parents. Because this is intended as a task force, it will hopefully go on to Ways and Means, and as a result, the Legislative Fiscal Office has issued a light analysis on this. So more analysis will be done in Ways and Means.
Great. Yes, Senator Pinot.
So the amendments basically eliminate the original part of the bill dealing with unionizing foster parents?
It does. You know, I think the intent of the bill in its original form was to help build supports for people who are in a foster care parenting situation, and also to, you know, to clarify their relationship with the state. What is the state's responsibility to support them, to train them, to keep an eye on them, frankly, and, you know, in certain circumstances. But then also, and one of the charges of the task force is to look at ways in which the parents can support each other and, you know, organize among themselves to provide networks of support and, you know, a joint ability to interact with DHS and the state.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
When you use the term organized, I'm automatically thinking unionize. So am I wrong in thinking that that might still be the direction, or?
It is conceivable. That
okay,
this group,
so.
You know, yes,
totally off
yes.
Base.
But, you know, certainly if you look at the makeup of the task force, I think it's broadly representative of the world of foster care and includes some members that are appointed by the speaker and the president, others by the governor, others by the chief justice, there'll be a CASA and somebody, a judge, and somebody from the judicial support organization. So, you know, certainly if they end up with a suggestion that some form of unionization is called for, that would be part of their recommendation. But certainly the task force is not set up to make that anything automatic.
Okay, so no later than next February. Report
yeah.
By the following October. Okay.
The task force also includes, of course, several parents, and as well as some foster youth, current and former.
Can I have a short recess?
Sure. Okay, let's stand at ease.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back on the record. Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, can we have a motion to adopt these amendments?
Chair Dembro, I move to adopt the -3 amendment dated April 15th, 2015.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved to adopt the -3 amendments dated April 15th, 2015. Any further discussion of the amendments?
Yep, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Knope.
So on page 2, lines 20 and 21, I think it's where it talks about trying to find it on here on OLS.
Yeah.
Do you want that?
Well, I'm getting there. I'm just slower than you.
Okay.
High-tech people. So I guess the concern I would have is that I'm very supportive of the foster parents and the foster parent program, but don't think the right direction to go is to unionize foster parents. I think that'd be a mistake. So I would want to support a task force or a study that studies the unionization of a foster parents, because I think it's a unique job, and that job really is parenting kids who are going through life's most difficult times, and well, you know, I am supportive of employees' right to want to organize. I think this is a unique place where I don't think it would be appropriate. So I'll probably be a no on the amendments and a no on the bill itself.
So I'll just point out, just for the record, I'll read the sentence that's at issue here is, or it's part of the list of the charge that for the task force will study and make recommendations on foster care program quality and workforce issues related to the provision of foster care, including but not limited to, and this is H, models for foster parents to more effectively organize to advocate for improved standards and compensation. And, you know, I think you'll appreciate how far this bill has come.
Indeed.
And certainly, you know, if this group were to recommend something like a path to unionization, that would come back to this body, certainly, and we would take action. This, our passing this task force bill with this as one of the elements for them to discuss, you know, I think certainly doesn't require anything. So, I mean, anything certain as far as that goes. But I appreciate your concern. Any further discussion of the dash threes?
I acknowledge that it is a huge improvement over what I saw as a pretty. I would really highly object to the original bill, but so I would much rather see the dash three, but I would not support the final bill as amended.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so. Seeing no further discussion, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelsert.
Aye.
Senator Knope.
No.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher.
Aye.
And Chair Deborah.
Aye. Okay, the dash three amendments are adopted. Senator Rosenbaum.
Yes, Chair Dembro, I move Senate Bill 311 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 311 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Or actually, any discussion of this motion? Okay, seeing none, Carrie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Gelsert?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Dembro?
Aye. The motion passes, and this bill will go to Ways and Means. I'll close our work session on Senate Bill 311 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 137. Matt, can you tell us what this is, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 137 is causing problems to my computer. I'm sorry. Senate Bill 137 defines public works for projects, or defines a public works project for the purpose of applying prevailing wage as ones that use the funds of a private entity and at least $750,000 of funds of a public agency for construction, reconstruction, painting, or major renovation on a publicly or privately owned road, highway, building, structure, or improvement. That measure becomes operative January 1st, 2016, and declares an emergency effective on passage. There are dash one amendments to this measure that remove the requirement of private investment from the definition of public works project.
Okay, thank you, Matt. So, what do we have here? John Mullis, Ryan Tribbett.
It's kind of Michael Eisen.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, Mike, you want to come up too?
Mike's not here.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right, we'll go for second best.
Oh.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Molis. I represent the Oregon State Building Trades Council. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to Senate Bill 137. A little past history. In the 2000s, public-private partnerships started becoming a more frequent way of doing projects. And in some cases, public agencies or entities would give pretty good sums of money, sometimes millions of dollars, to private developers to build a project. And there wasn't any real rules of the road that governed that as far as when prevailing wage would kick in or apply. And a group got together, tried to come up with a solution. They weren't successful. Meanwhile, problems continued. There were lawsuits filed. Some contractors would start projects with the assumption that the project didn't prevail, and then a determination would come along that that did prevail. And so folks before me got a group together of labor and contractors and management and some contracting agencies and decided that $750,000 seemed like a fair number, that if a public agency gave $750,000 or more for a private development, then prevailing wage would apply. And that bill passed in 2007 and has worked quite well, as far as I'm concerned. It just draws a line and delineates when prevailing wage applies and when it doesn't. Last year, a project came up that, and I think the law specifically refers to a project on private land. Last year, a project came up that had over $750,000 of public money going to help build the project. In fact, it was over $1 million, but the project was built. Was going to be built on public land, and so there's some questions raised on whether the law would apply. The law also speaks to this money going to a developer and the developer providing funds, and this project was being funded solely by grants and loans. There wasn't any private money in the project. So those concerns were raised. We went to Boley. They helped us craft some language that's in this proposal. And so our desire is to go back to what we believe is the original intent of the law, to which when a public agency gives $750,000 or more, prevailing wage applies. And we don't care if it's public land or private land. If they're not having to give in some of their own money, I think the principle was when that much public money is awarded, then prevailing wage applies. So we're not asking to change any intent. We're not asking to change the $750,000 threshold. We just want to close those two loopholes that we believe have been identified. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if you or anyone has any questions, I would do my best to answer them.
Okay. Thank you, John. Ryan?
Ryan Tribbett here on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Association of Wall and Ceiling Contractors. Just here to offer our support for the bill. I don't want to reiterate what he said, but we think that there is value to land. It constitutes additional public investment in a project and shouldn't be used as some sort of exemption from the $750,000 threshold. So a good bill should pass. We would like to see the Dash Ones adopted too, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.
John. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, John Rackwoods for the record with Associated General Contractors. And we've all been working together with Boley and the proponents of this bill because it is such a complex area of the law. And so that's why on our little sheet there's no position. And what's important to us today is to simply make clear for the legislative record that we're trying to get at a narrow issue here, and that's when a public agency leases out publicly owned space to a private entity and then provides that $750,000 or more, that the intent of the original law, this is a particular unique development approach, that the law should account for that and prevailing wage would kick in. What's really important to us, and we've been assured over and over and wanted on the record, is that there is no intent to change the definition of public funds nor change the $750,000 threshold that triggers the prevailing wage requirement. That's all we really wanted to make sure of. Frankly, there have been three sets of different amendments drafted, and this one is one, and I'm not sure We want to make sure it's as clean and clear and crisp as possible. And so we're good with what's going on as long as that legislative intent is in the record and people are in agreement with it. I will tell you, we've hired a lawyer to try to figure this out, and I'm not sure they did any better of a job than anybody else. So we've had at least a week of trying to come up with the language here. We just want to make sure legislative intent is to capture what was originally agreed to in the middle 2000s when mixed use became a whole new way of funding public type projects, but it was mixed. So happy to try to answer any questions. Probably have to call my attorney if it gets too complicated.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you. Any of you can answer this, but Mr. Chibet, it's nice to see you back before the committee testifying. Is the $750,000 index for inflation, or is that like in the 2000s bill, and that was the threshold?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Knope, it is not indexed. It's just stayed constant at the 750.
Okay.
And this is John. I'd like to, Rakowitz with AGC. I just, Chair Dembrough, Senator Knope, I'd like to weigh in on this. I came to AGC in 08, and this had been a bloody war. And it was incredibly difficult to come to an agreement. And that's why we're here, to make sure the agreement that is on record, the agreement that was reached, because here's the important point that Mr. Mullis pointed out. We don't want an owner and we don't want a contractor in a situation believing it's one or the other, and then suddenly boldly declares it is, oh, it's prevailed, and now your budget as an owner or your bid as a contractor has just been thrown up in the air, and nobody knows how they're going to deal with it. So it's the certainty that does help, I believe. And that's why we've stuck with the 750. It may have an arbitrary number, I don't know, but in the case that they're dealing with, it's $1.1 million, right? So when you get that kind of a substance in, that's what people agreed to at the table before my time.
Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Happen to remember what bill that was in your view in 2007?
Kate will probably figure it out. She'll be coming up next. We'll see if she can do it in 10 seconds.
All right.
We can certainly find out and get back if the hall doesn't know.
Great. Okay, thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Kate, I was just kidding.
It's 2944.
2944. Come on up.
The battle wounds are fresh.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall. I'm here today representing the Sheet Metal Contractors Association, the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association, Sheet Metal Workers 16, and the State Association of Electrical Workers, and the Plumber and Steamfitter Union Local 290. And I'll probably be dating myself just a little bit. The reason that I remember that bill number is because I had the great opportunity to work on that task force with Commissioner Gardner way back when, prior to the 2007 legislation. So what I would say is I think Senate Bill 137 is a very simple technical fix. I think when the legislation was passed in 2007, it really was about addressing the public-private partnerships that were increasing in frequency, and the intent really was to create a bright line around where these projects would be covered. And so some of the projects that were the public-private partnerships weren't always being covered by prevailing wage law, even though they were using a considerable amount of public resources. So again, the thing that just pops into my memory over and over, because it was so much of that conversation, was the $750,000 threshold was to create that bright line so that there was no question about whether a project was covered or not covered. So I think Senate Bill 137 very much keeps in the intent of that original legislation and that bright yellow line that if a project does have $750,000 of public funds, it's covered by prevailing wage law. So happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any other obscure points of fact?
Come on, I nailed my one. That was...
I don't know why. It just seems like a big thing to have left out. I mean, I'm just trying to remember back, because I think it was on the committee that was hearing that. I'm just looking at it, and it seems like it's big to have not have applied it to public land, and I'm just wondering how could that have been overlooked? It just seems like a big glaring error. And I didn't, well, anyway.
Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, if I can, I think that because the conversation around that at that time was so much around the private projects that used $750,000 of public funds. So I think that was just so much the focus and was not ever necessarily the intent. It was just the problem that was getting addressed.
Oh, I see. That's probably true.
Well, I think, you know, we're hoping to see more of these public-private partnerships, and we need clarity, and, you know, I think that's what this bill is designed to do. So thank you very much, Kate. Okay, is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 137. And colleagues, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 137. Senator Rosenbaum?
Yes, Chair Dembro, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 18th, 2015.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 18th, 2015. Any discussion of these Dash 1s? Okay, seeing none, is there any objection to the Dash 1s? Okay, so ordered, they are adopted. Senator Rosenbaum?
Chair Dembro, I move Senate Bill 137 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 137 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I think it's. I just remember that there was a lot of discussion around how much further or how much less far money could go when it was prevailed versus when it wasn't. And I remember that, yes, you do need a bright line, but I do think there needs to be a lot more serious consideration about indexing it, perhaps, or raising it. Raising that threshold, meaning the $750,000, not raising the prevailing wage. That already happens all by itself.
Colleagues, after the work of this committee sort of winds down, I'll be happy to schedule an information session on prevailing wage, and maybe we can explore some of those issues.
And Matt is just saying, you know, since I have to pay prevailing wage to people, I am going to declare a conflict, not that I think this really applies, but just, you know, to be abundantly out there. Just going to put that on there as a potential conflict.
Your potential conflict is noted. Thank you. Okay, Carrie, you want to call the roll?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator No?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
No.
Aye. The motion passes, and I'll carry it. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 137. And colleagues, that's it for this week. All right. See you Monday. Hopefully we'll.
Wednesday?
Yep. Hopefully we'll get things wrapped up during our 1-3 spot. If not, we're holding 6 o'clock for final votes. But hopefully we won't need it.
I was just thinking, I've got all those.
Okay, we are adjourned.
6, 6, 6. 10 o'clock.
That's how long you were here.
We were here. 6, 10 o'clock.
That's how long you were here.
We were here.